Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 7th, 1998. And this morning in the Koinonia Creekside room is Kathy Roberg. Her session is number 98-3, and it's titled The Comparative Risk Analysis. Let's listen in.
Long, so I'm going to try to keep it short this time. This is on public participation, and I hope I can enhance your view of what can be done and how to approach it. I've written on the board a Venn diagram showing what I think are three ways in which the public can participate. And I have purposely used a Venn diagram because they're not discrete methods. They tend to overlap, but I think there are some unique characteristics of each of them. That's why I've designed this type of thing I like to talk to you about. And also the hierarchy. There is no hierarchy. I don't put the active category above the other two for any reason. And I'd like to mention a few things. First of all, that is, there is more and more possibilities for people to participate in environmental decisions. In fact, it's being mandated now. The EPA must have public comment periods, so the public is encouraged to come. And when the public does come, either they can verbally give a response or they can write a written response, and the EPA must respond to all responses. They must answer all questions asked. And that's what I would call the proactive, where you present information. As a public, I would go to a meeting and say, well, or just present a concern, say, have you thought about this aspect of it? Environmental issues tend to be so large that even though the scientists or the decision makers might have come to some sort of agreement or compromise, it doesn't cover all the concerns that could be raised about it. So they're counting on the public to participate. That would be the proactive. Proactive meaning, you know, you're going out and doing something while the process is being involved. Above that I have active, and that would be for those involved in making discretionary decisions or determining an agenda. Typically this might be if you're involved with city council or if you're on the county board of commissioners. Typically, which is something that requires quite a bit of involvement. And lastly, I called this defiance, and I thought I didn't want to make it sound like you're aggravating something, but so I called it defense. And there is legitimate times when people need to say, no, this is really wrong. Even though the decision has been made, this influences or this is a detriment to our community, and we won't stand for it. There will be times. And so I have put down some things like demonstrations, litigation, civil disobedience, those type of things. So they're all part of it. I'd like to give a couple of examples from the work that I've done, and I'd like to also ask you if you've had some examples too for some any way you've been active. For proactive, in our region of Indiana, we have something called the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And this is a group of individuals, and which includes the mayors, includes the presidents of the universities, includes the leaders of representatives of environmental groups, and leaders of health organizations, and leaders of religious organizations. And I shouldn't stop there. The League of Women Voters sends a delegate. You know, everyone who wants to have a say goes there. And they have been talking about all sorts of issues for our region. Number one would probably be transportation. We have no public transportation, or I should say, we have very little public transportation. And so this is one of the issues that all these people are getting together for. The reason, you can imagine the reason, is because we live in northwestern Indiana, which has Gary, Indiana, as one of the cities, and then southern Lake County is one of the most affluent areas in that county. And so you've got people having an underlying fear of racism when they talk about transportation. We don't want them coming into our neighborhood. So there are many aspects of environmental issues. And you can see how transportation is really an environmental issue because we are just polluting terribly in the region. We're one of the major expressways going through there. So we need to discuss this, but it can't be just solved by scientists or by the mayors or by authority, transportation authority, it has to be solved by the whole community. It's a very difficult issue. Yesterday, if you were at lunch, you might have heard someone say that they were asking for signatures on a petition to ban personal watercraft in, was it the Olympic
National Park?
Yeah, and I thought that was a very interesting demonstration of the proactive public participation. And also, I was interested in how it was presented. If you remember, they mentioned the statistics of it. They said the amount of pollution, petroleum on the water pollution was equivalent to, I think, is it 5 or 6 W, 4 W. And they also talked about noise pollution. And I think this is something that's becoming more interest to groups, is that how we care for our environment is not just the scientific nitty-gritty. You know, does this cause death? Does this kind of pollution cause death? But it's even the aesthetics. If you go to the National Forest, you might want to have it peace and quiet. And that is something that could be brought up in a proactive form. And that's what she mentioned. Very interesting. In terms of the active part, our city has what's called the Millennium Committee for 2000. We want to set some new goals for the community. And the mayor has asked residents, you don't have to be a citizen, residents to come join together on a committee and look at the long-term planning for the community. And that would be what I consider more active, because then they'll be making some, either determining the agenda for the community or possibly making discretionary decisions. And lastly, defense. I was actually on the other side. I was very pro for the activity that was going on, and the other people were against it, so I'll tell you a little bit about that one. I mentioned it on Monday, so if you were on Monday, you heard already a little bit, but I'll tell you the whole scoop now. Napalm was coming to one of our communities. Napalm, you recognize the name from the Vietnam War. It was a defoliant. It catches on fire and burns down vegetation. And there's you probably remember the picture of the little girl running down the street with napalm on her body. And it burns for a long period of time. But napalm has been stored in California, and it's now a Superfund site. All the napalm that was made, it's just made of benzene and styrofoam. So if you took a styrofoam cup and put it in something like gasoline, you would be making napalm. So that's basically what it is. There's a Superfund site that needed to be cleaned up, and so the Navy is trying to find a way to clean it up. So they requested proposals for cleaning up the Superfund site, and Pollution Control Industries, which is our local hazardous waste recycler, put in a bid, and they won the Navy contract out of 130 cents. And I toured the facility. It's really slick. They bring the things in barrels, 55-gallon barrels. It goes in. It's totally contained. It's under nitrogen, so there's no air for combustion. Inside, they have metal claws that slash the barrel to break everything up. The barrel gets rinsed, and it goes down another chute to be recycled. All the liquid comes out, it's jelly. It's very thick stuff. You pour it like honey. Napalm's like honey. So that would drip down, be washed down, mixed with the solvent. Then it would be put into another container and sent to cement kilns to be burned. And to me, I thought that was a very wonderful way of looking at how to dispose of a hazardous material. Now, interesting thing is when PCI got this contract, they didn't tell anyone. They didn't tell anyone in the community. They didn't think anything would be said about it. And then one of the politicians in Chicago found out that the napalm would be shipped through his area, and we suspect that, you know, oftentimes politicians want the name in the paper associated with something pretty exciting that everyone would read about. And so he alerted people that this would be coming through, and then that, of course, put people in uproar because they thought napalm, how awful, how terrible. And so that's how it got started, and then there was a lot of then all the communities were in uproar. So then PCI had to went to great lengths to educate people. In fact, this stuff is not explosive. They do demonstration. I took a class in their hood. They put some gasoline in, they lit a match, and you could watch it burn and burn and burn until it finally went out. Put some napalm down, put a match on it. It burned for a little bit, and then before the fuel was even gone, it just extinguished itself. It just could not survive in the flame that it was in the container that it was in. So it wasn't even particularly flammable. It's not the way it was being shipped, it was not going to explode, and it was not particularly flammable. And then people who were not opposed to this said, you know, we ship gasoline to our communities all the time. Now that is something that is explosive. There's a potential for great danger there. And if it leaked, it would go into the groundwater, whereas if napalm, if it did leak, as it has done on the Superfund site, it just sort of sits on the ground because it's this thick honey stuff, it can't even get into the ground. So it still could be cleaned up. Okay, so that was the initial concern, and then it was interesting because the environmental groups, I'm a member of environmental groups, so I hear deep into both sides of the plants, and people say, oh, this is great, this is something to galvanize a community on environmental issues, irregardless of whether it was totally correct or not, whether the information was correct, and it wasn't because they were playing on the explosive part. And the newspaper, the PCI sued one of the journalists for publishing this information that, you know, people would say, oh, it might explode my community. Now, this was someone else who had quoted it, but they sued the journalist who knew it would not explode and still printed this individual's response. It's a very ugly affair. And finally, when this was sort of resolved, then the community said, okay, why don't we want this coming to our community? And then they started looking at it saying, you know why we don't want it coming? Because we are the dumping ground. We already have a hazardous waste disposal facility that reformulates hazardous waste, paints, solvents come in, they gather it, you probably have one in your community, they gather it periodically throughout the year, and they reformulate it. They typically send it to cement kilns where they burn it. We already have this in our community, and it doesn't smell very good. We can smell the solvents. And PCI, this company, has not made good neighbors because when the neighborhood complained, they said, okay, we'll buy you out. You can move. And they did. They bought the region, the outlying or surrounding homes and bought them out. So they've been, the community has been very antagonistic towards this company for a long time. And finally, they said, because we don't want to be dumped on, that's what we're going to band together. And they did. And finally, PCI said, I give up. Now, let me tell you the whole story. PCI was out of compliance with some of the regulations. They were under an agreed order, which is kind of the lowest of the penalties, and that means you better fix this up or you won't be allowed to run. Now, being out of compliance meant their drums were not exactly 18 inches apart. Maybe they were 17 inches apart. So there were they were out of compliance for a lot of things that don't seem to be so terrifying. However, they still were out of compliance, and that's another reason why they shouldn't be given the contract. No company out of compliance with the EPA should be given, this is a federal law, shall be given a contract to do federal work, and this was federal work. So it all came in, and finally PCI said, you know what? We have spent so much money just on trying to calm the community down. It's not worth it. We're going to lose more than we'll ever make by converting the napalm to usable products. So they bowed out, and now it's going to Texas. So, but, you know, even though I think it should have come to Chicago, there's a lot of dirty work that has to be done. Someone's got to do it. We're all going to have to do our part, even in my own backyard. It was a couple miles from my school in Londonderry, over 8 hours a day. So I'd be, you know, if anything's going to blow up or if anything's going to cause bad fumes, I'm going to be right there. And yet I feel that this was an important project. However, I am very proud of the community to say no. So on one hand, I think it was a poor decision. On the other hand, I think it was wonderful that the community is taking control of their community and saying, you know, we are doing some good things here, but we don't want to get dumped on. So that's in part of defense. Those are three examples that I've had from each of those three categories. Does anybody have any experience with any of these kind of categories? Any sort of participation in the talk?
Well, only the proactive side is writing letters to congressmen all the time.
Yeah.
And some of them are very, very good, and some of them are just might as well not waste your breath.
You mean for the congressmen?
Yeah, like Slade Gordon, British Senator Slade Gordon. You might as well not even write him. He'll just come back and say something so they get lost, kind of thing. And have that over and over again with him.
Oh.
But I belong to the Audubon Society, and they're very proactive in many ways.
Yeah, they have. Audubon Society's both proactive and, well, actually all three. Sierra Club, same thing. They'll do proactive, they're part of the active, and then they'll always go to the defense, too.
Yeah.
Kathy, I have a question more than a comment. I'm always reading these articles. I'm very concerned about it. We have a big EPA project going on in Coeur d'Alene, not far from Spokane right now, that's hitting the news. And I read through the newspaper articles, and I read, you know, the rhetoric of both sides, and I just get so confused because I don't know enough about the particular chemicals and things that are there to be able to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
You have an expertise which allows you to go through and cut through the crap, literally. And I just find myself, you know, like, I would have been sort of on the knee-jerk side saying, no, don't bring that napalm into our community. I would have been one of those people because I didn't have the knowledge that you have to be able to evaluate whether that's done safely. And I want to have a more balanced perspective and be able to say, you know, when this needs to be done and what's the appropriate thing and so on. How can the sort of layperson who's not scientifically sophisticated make those kinds of decisions?
Actually, going to the public comment periods that they have for various remediations is really helpful because the public, they will ask questions, and the APA responds to them. If they can respond to them right there, they can usually respond. They hire the best people who are people, you know, can talk to people without looking down or without being arrogant, without using scientific jargon.
Mm-hmm.
And they will explain things as clearly as possible. So if you're one of those, I don't know if they would do it in Spokane, maybe because there's involved. That's a really great place to hear more of the true scoop. And also environmental groups, if any of them are participating in this, you know, their newsletter, oftentimes they'll write much more than what's in the newspaper about the issue. And oftentimes there will be people who have various expertise. I'm very interested in the legal aspects of the issues, and there's a lawyer who's in charge of one of our environmental groups, and that's how I get the scoop from him, although I find that going back and forth, since I do straddle the scientific community and then the environmental groups, get a much more balanced picture, because even my friend who's a lawyer, some of the things he tells me are just not true, and I don't find that out until I go and ask them. That's really
tough. You know, even the environmental groups, which I usually am very supportive of, I find sometimes their rhetoric is very inflamed and inaccurate sometimes. So it's hard for me often to judge. I mean, I know inflammatory rhetoric when I see it, but I don't know what's underneath it.
And oftentimes it's the inflammatory rhetoric that urges people to motion or action. Any other comments on participation?
I'm one of the tree-hugging kind of people, and care a lot about that kind of environmental issue, which is really not the center of our discussion here today, but also being from Central Washington, you know, we've had a long, flowing conversations about the nuclear production plant in Hanford, and there have been this long history of poor controls, releases, with good evidence of injury that's pretty subtle. And a lot of concerns about groundwater contamination and lousy techniques that have gone on for years in terms of, quote, cleanup effort. still not getting anywhere. And finally, you know, I'm hearing our governor today say, enough talk, we've got to get something done. However, with that, all of that aside, I'm also, and that's why I'm willing to raise that to you, aware that, you know, we've created a lot of nuclear paranoia. Some of it, I think, well justified. I mean, I kind of like this handout of Gertz because it's saying, you know, League of Women Voters says nuclear power is the number one concern, and the experts have it down to 20. Mm-hmm. It says a lot. You know, I've taken care of some of the Hanford workers who go all over the world making reactors. We say, you know, the Americans are really stupid. You know, the French got one pattern, one plan design, which is a, I don't know, PE plan or something. Then they reproduced that. They got good at that. They created a lot of safety. You know, where stateside, every time we've done a reactor, we've started from scratch, got new bids, you know, it's all of that stuff. And re-engineering and making the same mistakes over and over again. Whereas around the world, there are multiple examples of long-running electric, you know, nuclear plants that have not created the Chernobyls that we hear about. I'm thinking that that's maybe an example of overreaction. I was wondering what your thought would be about.
I actually hadn't heard that idea that the French use one plant protocol, but French, I think, are on one of the top of the list, French, maybe French or Japan, for using nuclear power.
I think up with 15 or 20 or more.
Oh, yeah, quite a few. I think it's over 50% of their power comes from nuclear.
Yeah, I've been doing for years.
Yeah. Going back to what you said earlier, is I wish Washington State could be more proactive in terms of the hand for, this is way off, but the hand for cleanup, because, it's horrible.
It's
the
ridiculous how long it's gone on. And I agree with the sentiment about Slade Gordon, I heard that. Yeah. For the inactive. Yeah. But I've kind of given up trying to impact some of my efforts, usually to kind of adopt an area that I care about. Mm-hmm. There's one particular meadow that's deeded, that's been abused, and trying to, you know, be a small voice of concern to the Forest Service, who are still busy selling clear cutting.
That's important, though, that even though the Forest Service cannot do it all, even though they might have their heart in it, they can't do it all. It really does require public participation. I appreciate that.
Yeah, my discouragement is kind of like there's only 5% left and we're scrapping. Mm-hmm. 10 dogs, about one more bone is left in terms of full growth. And it's kind of, we've got to approach that whole thing in a different way, long term.
I think one interesting thing looking at this list too, or I guess two things that strike me. One is the extent to which a mistake can cause widespread damage or not. And I think that's one thing that is a concern for a lot of people. And because of the fact that it's, I don't know if anyone's read E.F. Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful. You know, it's kind of a classic and it gets a little kind of out there towards the end. But an interesting book in the sense of looking at the bigger things get, the bigger the mistakes get to be. And I think that's kind of one concern that people have with nuclear power and other major issues like that, where it's the size of damage that one mistake can cost. And then I think another one too has to do with what we in sociology call the sense of agency. That is, it's one thing for one person to choose to smoke a cigarette and to do something to themselves. It's another thing for a society to make a huge decision like to commit to nuclear or whatever. And so the amount of control that people feel they have over some of these environmental issues. Water quality is, I don't know, and I have no idea why, it's always been a concern of mine. Maybe it's because I know it's tapped right into my, you know, my house, but one of the things that I fear almost in an irrational sense is drinking the very, you know, drinking something that I have no idea, you know, what it could contain. And I think so. I think sometimes that loss of control, where it's not a decision that I've made, to you know, when I go mountain climbing, I know what the risks are, you know. But it's the not knowing sometimes that I think scares people.
Yeah, we sort of jumped into here. There's my next item. So I would like to go ahead and do this. I want to make one comment, and that is, when policymakers look at something like the magnitude of the possibility of something going wrong with the nuclear industry, they also consider the probability. And although the magnitude is phenomenal, the probability is minuscule. So that's the balance that they use to make those decisions. I'm sure you know that too. The other thing that he's mentioning is, why is it? He's already looking down this list. And I think I'd like you to do that now. Look down the list. And one of the interesting features is, how do we perceive risk when, as a public person, we don't have all the data? And I think it's important to look into your perception of risks and find out what are some of the attitudes that you have, and how will this affect how you address some of the market issues. And if you look right down the list, want to apologize that they put the League of Women Voters first, because I don't think that they intended to be sort of the guideline. And but I think that, anyway, they did. They took another category of college students, so it'll be interesting to see how they compare it against the other people. Active club members would be like gardening clubs in cities, various clubs that are founded who would do the survey. And then experts were actually EPA members. So these are basically technical experts in the area. And a technical expert in nuclear power might not know as much as about bicycling, so they're not always correct. Even though it says expert, that doesn't mean that this column is correct. Okay, so that column. But what I want you to do is look at the various activities or technologies and look where the greatest discrepancies are. And the first one you see is nuclear power. What I'd like to ask you is, why is there such a great discrepancy? And Jeff offered a suggestion for a great discrepancy. I think this.
Yeah, the amount of damage that
Could possibly occur, and a safeguard of the future. Of course, and this is also a perceived risk for death, by the way. So there hasn't been a lot of death from the nuclear industry. But I think when we make environmental decisions, we can't look at just that. We have to look at even the aesthetics, like we talked about, for sound in the natural national forests. Okay, so we have, I want to write down some of these, because these attitudes are terribly important. So, I don't know, Jeff, if you want to call that something like long-term effects?
Sure.
And maybe magnitude of the problem?
Yeah, maybe.
Look down the list, but if you have another idea, why is there such a discrepancy between what EPA experts and these other categories of participants felt?
Contraception is a striking
thing.
I'm thinking the college students are concerned about the AIDS virus and also the possibility of accidental pregnancy as a perceived health risk and danger.
Yeah.
When in fact the League of Women Voters and the club members don't see that, and then the EPA actually do, the EPA experts actually do see this fairly high.
I wonder if they mean if contraception is not used, risk of childbirth, or
if there's like the sort of post
IUD,
you know,
or venereal disease.
Yeah.
One that I'm not sure I understand is the term non-nuclear electric power. What is that? Is that
prime coal
or
hydro?
Yeah.
Or is that
big coal water probably?
Is that electrical hazards in homes? Is that what that's speaking to, or
production?
No, I believe it's production. Yeah, they do have down below home appliances.
The other interesting one is x-rays, what the experts have down there
that sticks out.
What do you think is the underlying attitude? Why do these other groups think that it is not very harmful? Wait, where have we gotten? The riskiest activity has the lowest number.
Yeah, the experts say that it's fairly dangerous, and the other ones say no, it's not.
Yes, right. Okay, so it's not.
I'd almost think it would be the opposite.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it has to do with the education. I mean, we've been educated to say that X-ray, you know, everyone's been told, don't worry about X-rays. If you have, you know, a couple of years, you're okay. So you can actually be out, you know, kind of over-educated out of a fear of something, I think, in some ways. Whereas the experts can still be a little bit more concerned. I mean, the nuclear issue is a good example of that, because I have a lot of friends in Eastern Washington who would say there has never been an escape of radiation, and it's not a problem, and you believe it. And then all of a sudden there was one, and oh wait, there were two. And so, to some degree, there is a cynicism there too, even sometimes. But for a period in time, you believe of that education.
Yeah, I had a couple of years. The area sort of sounded like you were saying, here, educated out of fear, we get some familiar with something that we feel it's safe because we've done it. Mm-hmm. How about bicycling and mouth climbing? What would you say? What was the underlying attitude?
Pesticides?
Oh, pesticides. I thought you said exercise, sorry.
Oh, no.
Pesticides, too. What is the underlying attitude that makes this huge discrepancy between active club members and college students and experts? Or wait, I got the right
Garden club versus the Sierra Club. I guess it's a little different category. But mountain climbing and pesticides. So are we on pesticides?
Yeah, either one.
Than the garden club.
Your knowledge base.
Knowledge. Okay, yeah. Knowledge base.
Right.
Like
college students are where you come from. Mm-hmm.
Everybody's agreed about prescription antibiotics, I see.
If you don't wear a helmet, you're in more trouble biting than you do. So it's,
Yes, right. Probably be the level of competence and
different ordering.
Yeah.
I think a lot of what happens too is just the press. You know, sensationalizing things just for the sake of selling papers and whatnot. They'll blow up any day when you're going to sell papers.
Sure, sure. That's a good commercial education older.
You know, the accident that happened with Sonny Bono and one of the Kennedys, you know, the skiing accident hitting a tree, that was just blown up, and you'd think there were 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people a week, you know, hitting trees and dying, and, you know, one or two a year.
And then
all of a sudden all these, you know, we've got to pass regulations, we have to have helmets, you know, face guards, you know, full body armor, that kind of a thing. That was, overdone.
But yet, wasn't the thing was too that he was doing an activity that the average person wouldn't even thought they could even try.
And they were born.
Yeah, right. I mean, so they were way out of compliance of
you mean,
an average
like football,
person.
Or are you talking about
right with the ski thing? It was just
running into a tree and playing football at the same time.
Yeah.
To me, common sense would tell you don't do things like that.
Yeah.
But sometimes the elite does things they know better, but they don't realize the consequences of it.
Gets
everybody in trouble.
So there's some sort of cavalier attitude that it won't happen to me.
Protracted youth.
Pardon me, what was that?
Protracted youth phase.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Let's go back to pesticides. There's pesticides, food preservatives, prescription antibiotics, I'm trying to think of, and smoking, maybe not as much. How do you think the amount of voluntary control here would play into, I'm changing the topics now. Voluntary control, such as swimming. Swimming is one where, two-thirds of the way down, you see there's quite a discrepancy there. In fact, I'm taking this from Stephen Breyer, who's a Supreme Court Justice, his book, Breaking the Vicious Circle. And he makes a different point from this, but I want to take his data, and I have added on another table to make a slightly different point. But he says that he finds that people's values are based on whether a activity or a technology is voluntary or not. For instance, smoking is voluntary, so the perceived risk is much lower than possibly, actually here everyone has it pretty high. But he says whether something is voluntary or involuntary lends a large hand to how we perceive the risk. Mm-hmm. And the other thing he really gets on a bandwagon about is the fear of cancer. And he calls this a dread fear. So I'll just go ahead and put dread fear. If we think something might cause cancer, then we're much more likely to regulate it than if it caused something else. And he makes a very valid point of neurotoxins. A lot of solids are neurotoxins, and we hardly have any regulations on neurotoxins. Whereas anything that might have or does have any propensity to cause cancer, such as atrazine, which was an herbicide used in cornfields that has been highly regulated. EDB used also is a grain fumigant that's been highly regulated, and the risk, the rate of cancer is pretty slim actually. So when you balance it out to the other risks that there are, it seems odd that we go after some things so vehemently. That's a little bit of this concern.
One of the things I thought of in that same vein is that is the issue of the universality of the activity that certainly upsets this balance. You know, some things that most of us never do. You know, I've never been a policeman. You know, that's just pretty. Mm-hmm. But almost all of us drive a car.
Yeah.
And that's certainly a major risk. So that's hard to balance that list in terms of risks. But it seems like how much we do this stuff is another important variable.
Well, and that's a similar thing to, for example, you and I were talking about this. I teach this homeless class on Down and Out in America, and it's scary to everyone who doesn't do it. Because you go and you sleep under bridges for a couple of nights, and everyone's like really, you know. And so you wind up talking with parents, and the college president is kind of like, "What are you doing?" And yet, the students are really amazed because it's a very common thing to them. Once they learn what is truly risky and what isn't, it's very commonplace. But along with what he was saying, it's the notion that not many people do it, or they don't have a knowledge of what's really going on. We don't know what some of the rules are. That's often kind of what scares us. So that when when everyone drives a car, relatively speaking, we can say, well, we know what those risks are. But when it's something that's sort of exceptional, I think cancer and cancer-producing agents is one of those things where we don't know. We don't always have a knowledge of what it would really do to us in some ways. So, ties in with the education of it too.
Well, the next step is to take some of these and go to the next table over, table 25, 21. I'm sorry, there's so many numbers here. But I'd like you to focus on a couple of them. And it's like, if anybody has stars on theirs, that's my original sheet.
This is yours,
too. Okay, thank you. I'm out of time, if I don't have to read and sort through these. I'd like you to compare biking, football, and air travel. They're on the table on the right-hand side, the second, third, and maybe fifth air travel. Look at those statistics and figure out which is the most risky.
Football.
By and large, 4 in 100,000, then followed by biking, then air travel, 3 in 1,000,000. That's not a lot. Now compare those same three, biking, football, and air travel, over with they're listed on the other category. Bicycles is smack dab in the middle. Now bicycles, we know, is fairly risky. Football is very risky. And if you look at, actually, better examples, commercial aviation, which is just one below middle. You see commercial aviation. Everyone sort of lists it's about the same, 17, 16, 18, 16, sort of in the middle of the whole pot of risks. Whereas high school football, how do they risk
How do they rate the categories? High or low? Lower than this. Now, if you compare that commercial aviation, what in reality is the risk? Is the risk of death per year? Just, yeah. And so if you compare just the experts alone, the experts rate commercial aviation as 16th from their list, and high school and college football is 27, not very risky at all. And yet in reality, it's just the other way. So you can see that these EPA experts have the same perceived notions of risk that everyone else does. And this is, I think, one point that I'd like to make is if you carefully analyze the true risks of the issue, then you can make a much greater case for yourself when you go to public meetings like this. The next thing is to look at the next category. Now, I'm going to follow along with what Breyer says, because he has an interesting point here. He's very upset about asbestos regulations set up in play. And so if you look at that, you can see that the annual rate of death due to various things, and they again list high school football is the fourth one down, and asbestos exposure in school. You can see asbestos exposure is pretty low compared to these other accidents or activities. Again, we see that a lot of this is this voluntary, involuntary phenomenon. And lastly, if you take this along with this sheet, and hunt for more numbers, sorry, but I'll try to point out what it is. If you find asbestos exposure, it's kind of in the middle on page 26 on the second sheet. Find asbestos occupational exposure limit on page 26. You follow along. That is the cost per premature death averted. And these are new regulations, and you see how as the year becomes more current, down the list, you can see that we have now expended quite a bit more per relief of premature death. Down to atrazine is something I was interested in. Atrazine, it's $92 billion per death. Now, if we compare this against what we learned before, football or driving a car, what would we pay for a safer car, safer cars? Would we pay the same amount of money to drive a safer car? And most of us would. We wouldn't. Who bought a Volvo? Not me. I would love one, but I don't have one. I'm not willing to pay that yet. Indirectly, I've paid for these things. Now, I don't mean to say that they're all negative. What I want to say is that there's a lot of underlying issues here. One is whether the exposure is voluntary or involuntary. Another one might be who is affected. If it is myself, if it is a certain category of people, if it is the youth, and I think one of our big concerns is youth in schools. So we don't want them to breathe asbestos, so we've made the asbestos ban pretty severe. So asbestos ban and asbestos occupational exposure would be for glass blowers and people who do any sort of insulation for hot elements, and then the asbestos ban is actually two lower. And you can see the $110 million per death averted. If you flip over, you can see some earlier bans and standards set. And the cost there is what I would call cheap, $100,000 per death averted for some of the earlier standards. This, of course, begs one issue. Should cost-benefit be considered in setting health standards? And in the statutes,
it never says anything about cost benefit. It should never be evaluated, or it just doesn't say whether it should or shouldn't. It just does not list it. So when our legislators got together and wrote this document, the documents for many of these, for instance, Clean Air Act and Water Act, it doesn't say use cost benefit analysis. But what we see happening now is that Breyer is saying, and he's saying this because he feels money is being wasted. He feels like we are cleaning up things beyond the limit that's required to be fairly clean. And what the EPA now is doing is comparative risk analysis. And they're calling on the community, saying every community has a wealth of environmental problems. We need to prioritize. Now, they use the word prioritize instead of doing cost benefit. But really what they're saying is, we have a finite amount of money, and how should we spend it? So they would like more input from the community, saying, what do you care more about, clean water, clean air? What would be the issue that your community wants to work with? And this is where it's really important for the community to get involved, because you have a say in what should be cleaned up first. But this is kind of a new, it's an up-and-coming phenomenon where the EPA is interested in getting the community involved. Do you have any comments on that? Couple comments. I like the ones on physical exercise, football and swimming. They look like pretty risky activities, and you wonder if you should ever do them again. And yet, here I would want to do the benefit. I say, well, the benefit of doing physical activities would be probably much greater than my risk of dying from these activities. It's awesome.
It's probably jumping in on you diving in and hitting your head, and you don't know what's under the water.
Yeah.
What are the risks of the ones?
Yeah, right. And you just hope a lot of people use smiles. Yes.
Spinal cord injuries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The thing that really strikes me so much is on that page where they talk about asbestos exposure, and then on the bottom is long-term smoking. When you look at the dangers of long-term smoking compared to all the other things, how incredibly high it is. And yet the people who are always complaining about water and, you know, stuff in our food, they're sitting there smoking as they're talking about what might be in their food or water. It seems so ridiculous that they don't realize what they're doing.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling to me when I...
Unbelievable.
Breyer lists all the risks here, this nuclear power hunting, all these. He lists them by the cigarette equivalents per year.
Most of
these risks are like one cigarette per year.
Yeah.
One cigarette, the risk is
equivalent
to one cigarette.
Well, it just shows how incredibly brainwashed you can become by a tobacco industry, mm-hmm. who glosses over it, makes it look like it's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And then I don't see the ads the last few weeks. They spent billions of dollars calling your senator, you know, that they're taking taxes away from the poor people. Mm-hmm. And all the stuff, it's just ridiculous.
You're going to start a new black market industry?
Yeah.
And all the sponsors of the top 10 tobacco ones, you know, call your senators, tell them not to vote for this, not to throw your tax in the middle class out, we don't need it.
Huh. I think it gets at the debate of what is voluntary. I mean, that's the whole part of what's being, you know, dealt in the court, too. Well, I guess one thing I have about the question I have about the EPA as well is there's been a long debate about what is the EPA or OSHA or FDA, who do they represent? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big question, because if you look at different administrations, it's the emphases have been different. At times, for example, the USDA is considered to be on the side of the people who are producing the meat, and then other times the USDA is seen as protecting the consumer. And the EPA went through a large phase with the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, as well as trying to reemphasize the notion of helping business and stimulating the economy. Well, if you're trying to stimulate the economy, but you're at the same time trying to protect the environment, sometimes they have these contradictory interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that has to do sometimes with that cynicism is, you know, it's, well, which version of the EPA do we have right now? You know, do we have the one that's trying to, that is maybe less funded than it should be, that is trying to help big business, or do we have the one that is going to protect people from the hazards? Mm-hmm. Because big business's main goal is not, in fact, to protect the environment.
Mm-hmm. The EPA also has a hard time on prioritizing. They did a study that it was called Unfinished Business, and they asked people, what do you think the major problems are, health problems or pollution problems, and then they tabulated that, correlated that to what, where the money is being spent, and it was not very well correlated. So even then, they, you know, as a bureaucrat, you get so focused on your expertise, water quality, that, and you have a budget to spend on that, and you do, and no one or very few people are involved in the whole picture, knowing are the priorities set properly. And EPA knows this, they can't do it all, so they're saying, okay, we're going to grow this out to more people who want to be involved in it. A couple comments on why people don't get involved. I think we live in a, what's that book called, something like Why People Don't Bowl Anymore. You know, we just don't have free time to do things like this, to be involved in other things. Pam mentioned just it's frustrating to know what's what. What is the truth? It's hard. It's frustrating to hear both sides of the story on it. Should cost-benefit analysis accompany health regulations? Should we do this prioritizing? Should the public be involved in prioritizing? That's a free-for-all. You want to be involved in that?
I think industry would do it for healthcare for individuals, but we won't do it for...
Well, that's a good
one. Yeah, actually, I wish Judy was here, because she works on the Oregon Health Plan, which precisely does that. It's got the federal grant to prioritize, but also look at quality of life issues. And then one of the problems they run into is also, well, whose quality of life are you talking about? Because there are different subcultural groups, and you know, and sometimes when you positively affect one person's quality of life, you may adversely affect someone else's.
Or it gets politicized, and the fellow, you know, the 90-year-old who needs a heart transplant gets rolled into the committee. and they give him his heart transplant. You know, it's pretty tough to say no. And you know, one of my views is that we're waiting for enough of a crisis so that it's enough political energy to really make it happen. You know, it's discouraging that it seems to take so long. Mm-hmm. For this kind of change to really take hold, mm-hmm. because it gets politicized.
Mm-hmm. I think my frustration with this whole second sheet that you handed out is it seems to indicate that American lives are worth a heck of a lot. And I'm just wondering, you know, I wonder what would happen if you take the same sort of chart and apply it to, say, even a place like South Africa, which is fairly wealthy. The amount of money per death, especially now when you factor in that they would probably be keeping records on the colored and the African, the blacks also. I mean, they would be minuscule. But then if you would look at places like India or China or, you know, these newly industrializing areas, how much concern are they giving to asbestos? And then what does that say about, you know, I guess, our brothers and sisters who are not American citizens in the global thing, and in global sort of in this global village? So that just sort of frustrates me.
You suffer largely at the hand of Western businesses.
Yeah. Where the big cigarette market is over there now.
Yeah, absolutely. They're still using asbestos in many places. They're still using DDT.
Well, I think it's just so obvious as Americans that we think our life is worth more than anybody else.
We really do.
Because if you hear there was an airplane crash in Sri Lanka, they'll say there are 500 people killed and two of them are Americans. Like,
I know.
But what about the other ones, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it was really important because there were two Americans killed. Mm-hmm. Which kind of gets me. Mm-hmm.
Well, to close up, and I'm about to show me on time this time, I'd like to give a couple of examples where I think the public has been invaluable. And one is for Indiana. We're going to dredge our harbor. It's polluted with PCBs and polyaromatic hydrocarbons. They have a public comment period for the environmental impact statements required. It is a two-volume tome. It's about, let's see, one is about this thick and the other one's similar. So 12 shelf inches to read to prepare yourself for this public comment period. This is probably another reason why people don't get involved. But people were able to say exactly what their concerns were. I had a scientific concern about the material they were going to use to contain the dredged material. And they did come back, and they addressed everyone's issue, or everyone's comment later when they came back. They had a first limit, so they said the draft environmental impact statement. They had a comment period, and then they come out with the environmental impact statement. And they addressed everyone's concern. And part of their concern was just how much PCB would be floating around. And the way the EPA dealt with this is they used a computer model to estimate this. And now the new environmental impact statement, the complete one, is due out this summer. In fact, it was due June. I don't know if it came out, but all of a sudden there's no information that, in fact, their model is probably way underestimating the amount of PCBs volatilizing. So I don't know. They'll have to readdress that. They'll have to have a partial addressing of that. I mentioned the PCI and napalm cleanup, and they did go to the community, they went to the schools, they did this demonstration to show how napalm, in fact, doesn't really even burn very well. It's not even not explosive. It is not explosive, and it's not very flammable. And one of the students said to them after they had done this, "Then why are you lying to us?" Because he was convinced that what he's hearing at home or what he's hearing at school, there, you know, someone's lying, and so he's thinking this. So I think that this is maybe the flip side of the coin, is that the public is not always the one in the know, and not always, rarely the one in the know, and really needs more information. But here we see that the public does need to be informed by public comment periods. And lastly, we have new ozone and new particulate matter standards in the United States. Sorry, a lot of examples from the United States, but Canadians. But one of the questions was, for whom shall we set the new standards? Should we set it for the general public? Should it be the average American? Should it be for the aged? Should it be for the youth? For the young? That was a very difficult question they grappled with. And they finally decided to set the standard for the aged and the youth. So our new standards are reflective of that.
Well, to recap, I think there's a couple of ways that you can be involved with public participation. I think that we have to know our attitudes in terms of risk analysis. I think that better prepares us to address some of the issues. I do encourage you to be involved. Thank you.
Thank you.